Hello and welcome to Safari Conversations, the Singita podcast. Even though we've been around for 30 years, we're relatively new to podcasting. But we are storytellers by nature and we've got so much to share with you. Alongside our conservation partners, we've been busy exploring and protecting Africa's wilderness. So join us as we unpack inspiring, fun, and sometimes crazy stories where you'll meet our incredible people and learn all about the special places in Africa that we call home. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, please subscribe so you don't miss out on future episodes.
Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of the Singita podcast, Safari Conversations. My name is Ross Cooper. I'm the resident photographer for Singita, and today's guest is Matt Perry, General Manager of Grameti Fund in the Grameti Reserve located in Tanzania. Welcome, Matt.
Thanks very much, Ross. It's good to chat to you today.
I appreciate your time. And Matt, as a custodian of more than 350,000 acres of the world-renowned Serengeti ecosystem in Tanzania, Singita's partnership with Grameti Fund has had a profound impact on the Serengeti ecosystem. Just to bring our listeners into understanding the Grameti Fund, it's a non-profit organization that not only conserve but also assist with community development in the region. And there's a number of initiatives. And today, I really want to try and touch base on a few of the initiatives because we don't have a lot of time to do all of them because there are so many, and that's really a great thing. But if we could touch base on a few of our initiatives, and before we do, Matt, if there's a possibility for you to take us back in time to where Grameti Fund started and maybe looking at where it started, what its sort of first core purpose was to where it has grown to today.
So if we backtrack 20 years, 2003 is when the Grameti Fund was born. And, you know, being an iconic landscape, the vision was to partner with government, in this case with the Ministry of Natural Resources and Tourism, and specifically through the Wildlife Division, and collectively work in terms of restoring the ecological integrity of this area, and then to work with the communities through upskilling and development initiatives to ensure that, you know, we build resilience into both the protected area system as well as within the communities, which is the priority for us as an organization. So if you can imagine a landscape, picture the Serengeti, you know, people sitting at home, this beautiful iconic area, but 20 years ago, this landscape was devoid of any resident wildlife. And so the challenges were quite significant. There was very little in terms of wildlife protection going on here at the time. So our work set about moving through the concession, 350,000 acres, and working with a very, very small team of rangers at the time who were all ex-poachers, and slowly but surely building that resilience into the ecosystem whereby the resident wildlife numbers could bounce back, which would then support a world-class safari operation. So it's taken us the better part of 10 years to restore that integrity. So in 2012, certainly we had seen numbers bouncing back to what they were beforehand. And yeah, that was where we started out. And now, 20 years later, there's been significant success and achievement. We've got a team of around 165 employees, and most of whom are from the community. There's opportunities that are being presented for these members of the community that 20 years ago they couldn't have dreamed about. And I think that's really what we're all about, is creating opportunity for our communities, ensuring that we maintain integrity within this ecosystem and within this landscape, both inside the protected area and outside, because the challenges on the horizon are significant. Climate change, biodiversity loss, everything that will impact not only wildlife, but us as humans as well. So we really take our responsibility quite seriously. And yeah, we're excited about the future as much as it is challenging. I think being in a position to drive impact on the ground is what keeps us going.
I couldn't agree more. I think just a mammoth task on the size of the area to rehabilitate it to its natural state has taken a good 20 years. Obviously, already within the last couple of years, you've seen substantial growth. One of the big tasks I would imagine that you had ahead of you was to stop the poaching that was happening within the area. And as I'm fairly fond of dogs, I always sort of lean towards the canine operation. I know that was something fairly newly incepted into the anti-poaching as a whole. Perhaps if you could guide our listeners as to some of the challenges you faced and how that came about to secure the region.
Sure, Ross. So we started off very small in the early years, and we've built up a team of rangers that are strategically positioned around the concession. And being well-trained, well-equipped, boots on the ground was the priority in those early years. But also to complement the rangers on the ground, we've brought in various other elements into anti-poaching model, one of which is the canine unit, who we've had now for around 5 to 6 years. We've got 4 dogs, 3 Belgian Malinois and 1 chocolate Labrador, 2 detection dogs and 2 tracking assets. And we've got a team of handlers who work with the dogs on a day-to-day basis, have a very close bond. And really, you know, they've added a huge value to our position in terms of being able to better secure the wildlife within the region and also adding value to other security agencies within the region, police, etc., and other government forces. So it's been a great asset for us. But since then, I think, you know, we've really embraced the use of technologies, innovative technologies, the use of a canine unit, and, you know, really just looking at all of the resources and the assets and technologies that are available to us to become more efficient.
And I think as you look at technological advancements throughout the world, we talk about AI quite a bit and where it's moving. Even having the dogs on the ground, is there sort of data or research that you're utilizing from those dogs in terms of the success rate that they have? Or are you looking at other technological advancements like drones or thermal imagery where you can secure the area far more?
So we're about to launch a research project into this particular area, is really trying to assess the impact that all of our anti-poaching assets have within the system. What impact are we having? And based off that, I feel we can really be better positioned to plan for the future. And this is when we'll look at other technologies. How do we bring in AI into our operation? How can it help us? First and foremost, I think one area that, for example, AI could help us is within the research space. And, you know, we have a camera trap system out in the concession, and we're getting hundreds of images coming from that. AI can help us very easily determine whether an image is of a person or of an animal, for example. So we're adopting it in that area as we speak. And no doubt, you know, in the future, I'm sure it will have more capacity to offer not only the anti-poaching space, but within other key focus areas for the Grimedi Fund. It's all about efficiencies and making our lives easier. And we certainly will be embracing the tech going forward. We aren't using any drone program at the moment. We did explore it previously. However, we've made the decision that we have some other areas that we would like to focus on over the next couple of years before we possibly look into using drone technology. But again, I think we will always keep abreast of what is on offer in terms of technological advances. And we like to pride ourselves as being an area where collaborators and innovators can come and test their products, their units. So very much looking forward to what the future holds in terms of technological innovation.
It's always a bit of a tough one because on the face value, we have guests that visit this environment and they're looking for the simplicity of safari and being in a luxurious lodge overlooking the serenity of the bushveld. And behind the scenes, it seems that technological advancements will definitely showcase far more what we can achieve in terms of data or research. Over the course of Grimedi Fund managing this ecosystem, one of the initiatives I wanted to touch base on with you is the rhino re-establishment. I know that through the various regions within the Serengeti, the eastern black rhino has thrived within this area. However, in this particular region, it literally became extinct. It was no longer a viable species that survived in this area. And there's definitely a bit of excitement with regards to your project. I'm hoping you could tell us a bit more about that.
It's a flagship project for the Grimedi Fund and for our partners, TAWA and the government of Tanzania. A very exciting project. I mean, 20 years ago, to be able to speak of a population within Grimedi was almost unbelievable. You just couldn't imagine having a free-ranging eastern black rhino population. But through significant effort by many, many people over the years, we are able to now talk about a free-ranging population here at Grimedi. And there's 2 elements to the project. We've focused on bringing in free-ranging wild animals from other recruitment areas and then working with zoos from around the world, in particular zoos in Europe and the US, to bring in zoo animals who are totally naive to the Serengeti landscape, but bringing them back home, essentially. And since 2007 is when we really kicked off with our re-establishment program. Started off with two zoo animals, and I'm actually delighted to share some news is that we celebrated the birth of a young calf from the very first female that we received back in 2007, which after all of this time is, you know, a real significant moment for this project. And we finally have proof of concept that you can use zoo stock to produce wild Serengeti black rhino. So it's really exciting for us. And then to, of course, recruit other free-ranging animals. Right now, we can only source animals from South Africa, Kenya, and then, of course, the population in the zoos. So it's rather small, but the 9 animals that we brought into Grimeti back in 2019 have gone on to produce calves. And so that's also been really successful. Unfortunately, we did lose one bull to disease, but that's to be expected. If one is to engage in rhino conservation, it's high risk, but also high reward. And that's why Grimeti has invested quite significantly into our whole ecological integrity story. We want to bring as much back to this landscape as we can. And being a flagship species of this area, being the most critically endangered of the 3 black rhino subspecies, we are committed to making sure that we create a population here that will go on to contribute to the meta population within the Serengeti and beyond. So very exciting.
I was actually sitting here sort of thinking I should crack a bottle of champagne for that. Come on.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely.
It's an unbelievable thing to imagine that a species that wasn't here at all for many, many years is sort of now coming back into its own. And given what you were telling me now, yesterday we actually took a drive around the enclosed area where some of the rhinos have been kept, and we got to see one of the eastern black rhinos at close range, which is incredible to see. And having the thought of being able to see a young calf, I think, just makes it more exciting. Just for the listeners to understand, that enclosed area we often refer to as a boma or enclosed area for Eric, the eastern black rhino, that area is unlike a zoo. It's got a number of small, I'm going to say, strands of electric wire that obviously allows Eric to know that there's a perimeter point to allow him to be rehabilitated within. That area is probably about 270 hectares in terms of size. So it is a fairly large movable area, and it obviously gives him enough space to rehabilitate himself to the natural environment and be exposed to the elements like tsetse flies, as well as the vegetation that grows naturally within the area. And many other species do actually move through that enclosed area quite freely. So he does get to interact or see other species that move within the ecosystem. Do you think that you'd probably bring in more?
Definitely. So we have recently signed off on MOU with the Tanzanian government, and our commitment within that agreement is to deliver more animals. Probably we will be recruiting 3 animals from zoo stock and then trying to source from South Africa potentially or Kenya. We're not entirely sure just yet. However, that is the commitment. It's really exciting. So we believe that in the next year, we should be able to at least bring in the first 3 from the zoos, and then possibly later in the year, we could look at bringing in some of the wild stock. But really exciting. And I think, you know, for us, the vision and to be able to sit here now and demonstrate, you know, what is possible is what is so exciting for us. And yes, it takes a lot of resources and a lot of time and effort to get to that point. But the benefits of just working within that space really provides so much more to the landscape as a whole. By working within just that one space, working with a critically endangered animal, we know that it provides benefit to not only the strengthening biodiversity, but also to the tourism offering and also to our communities as well.
For many of the listeners to understand that when rhinos are brought in from zoos, they require to be rehabilitated back into the wild to obviously assess their condition. There's obviously a high risk, as you mentioned, in bringing those animals in. And just given that particular bull that we saw yesterday coming from the US, could you let us know, like, what was the trip that endured that animal to get you? How long did it take?
Picture this. Eric is the bull rhino that you saw within the facility that we have. And he came from San Diego Zoo. Took a long journey to get here. And what a story it was. And for an animal to depart the city of San Diego and to arrive in the Serengeti is truly an emotional story, but an inspirational one. But it does take a lot of work. You know, being a naive zoo animal, bringing an animal such as Eric back into this ecosystem, one has to be aware that there are multiple risks. Disease is one of them. We have tsetse flies, and, you know, trips is a disease that affects black rhino, or rather naive black rhino, especially those that haven't been exposed to it over many generations. And you're looking at a 2 to 3 year rewilding program or rehabilitation program to get that animal back to some form of natural state where it can be released into an area where it is independent, where it's feeding for itself, where you've managed to make that animal somewhat wild in many ways so that it's responding to threats, whether that be lions or whether that be poachers. And you hope that within that time, the animal's natural instincts are restored and are then able to go on and make a contribution to the species within the ecosystem. So it is very management intensive. And we've also realized that at the end of the day, it also boils down to the personality of the rhino. Some are more adaptable and others are a bit more lazy. You know, they enjoy their comfort. So it's been quite interesting to see the different personalities with some of the zoo animals that we've worked with. But some might require only 2 years, where others might require 4 years, for example, to really adapt and become wild animals again, basically.
I think it's an incredible achievement. As you look back, I think it must be incredibly rewarding. Looking at the biodiversity of species that occurred in this region, you know, rhinos was one that required to be brought back or reintroduced into the region. Are there other species that are missing to the region that need to be reintroduced, or are they slowly moving back due to the security?
There are. So rhino was an obvious one. There aren't any others really. However, what we have noticed is that when we first started in 2003, a species such as roan antelope and patas monkey were more prevalent than they are now. We now, I think, on one roan antelope left on this protected area. Now, we haven't looked into the reasons as to why that is, but one theory is that because we've restored the integrity and other species have bounced back and there's different pressures associated with that, that perhaps this was marginal habitat for species like roan, for example, and with higher densities of predators. I mean, our lion and hyena densities have really increased because of the prey that is being made available through the protection. So, no, I don't believe there are any key species that are missing from this landscape, and in particular from this area that we operate in. And I think we have now reached a sort of an equilibrium whereby the ecological integrity of the area has now been restored. Yes, numbers are still low in certain species, but we've certainly seen the resident indicators are telling us that, you know, we're almost at a healthy state once again. We've still got a lot of work to do with the black rhino because their numbers probably we could accommodate, or they could be well over 100 within this area.
And I know that we've touched a little bit on research in some of the areas and what's being used by the Grimetti Fund. Are there a few aspects in terms of science or research that's looking at some of the data that you've got from species numbers in terms of total populations that they can say, well, lions are suddenly exploding to, you know, 500 or 600 lions? Is there research that you look at or data that you can track on to see that you've reached that equilibrium?
Absolutely. So I think, you know, every 2 years we do annual game count. Those are where we draw our indicators from. It tells us how many elephant we've got. It tells us how many buffalo we've got, for example. And in particular, we're looking at the resident species. We're not so interested in the migratory species. And we'll, from that information, from that data that we collect, we are able to then review that. And it provides us with a look into what is going on in the ecosystem. So Research and data is critical to inform management about what's going on. It allows us to assess whether we need to be adopting different strategies, different initiatives, different management protocols. And so it's absolutely key that, you know, we continue to work with the scientists, with the ecologists who provide the information and the data to ensure that what we are doing is responsible, and then to identify the gaps within the ecosystem. Where do we need to be, you know, looking in a little bit deeper in order for us to make better decisions going forward?
And I think that sort of ties into your initiative on ecosystem conservation. There's a number of aspects that you cover to ensure that this area is free of alien plants, for example, burning programs that take place for the purpose of regeneration of grass growth, etc. And can you perhaps just cover on some of those aspects?
One of the biggest threats that face the Serengeti landscape at present is invasive alien plants. It's a challenge, a threat that we've been tackling now for the better part of 10 years. And in that time, we've noticed a significant increase of different species and also movement of species.
Just to add how alien plants come into the system, I think for our listeners at home to understand that the ecosystem that we have, there's no fences or boundary. There's a boundary, but it's literally a post marking. So any estuary or river or drainage line from heavy rainfall will flow into this area, and that would bring seeds from alien plants, primates that feed on alien plants outside the reserve that move into the reserve. And that's where you sort of end up with this continuous problem of alien plant species coming in.
I mean, we call it the war of attrition because we're just trying to push back this barrier of invasives that keep coming into the protected area. But I think what's important to understand is, yes, it's important that we clear the invasives out of the protected area, but it's just as important to look at this challenge at a landscape level within the communities. Wildlife will be affected by invasive alien plants if we don't tackle this problem. But at the same time, the challenge that presents itself within the communities and within agriculture within those communities is significant. And unless we are able to tackle the problem within a regional landscape level, we are not going to win the war on this. And biodiversity is obviously going to take a knock. If we don't tackle this problem, it's going to cost millions and millions of dollars to eradicate this problem, or at least to get it to a point where it isn't affecting communities' livelihoods, nor is it having an impact on protected areas such as the Serengeti. There's a couple of species that are really quite aggressive, and one has to understand that if these invasive species are left unchecked, if we just use the wildebeest migration as an example, the one plant in particular, Parthenium, which is an allelopathic, it affects the soil around it, doesn't allow any other species to grow. And if that was to dominate the grasslands of the Serengeti, one can just imagine how that's going to impact on the million plus migrating herbivores within the system. So we understand what that threat is. We are looking into creating more awareness, sensitizing communities to the threats of invasive alien plants, and then also working with government and other collaborators, because we can't do this on our own. We cannot tackle this problem on our own. And therefore, as is our philosophy, we believe in collaboration and partnerships. And we'll start with that sensitization and look at ways of how we can mitigate this problem going forward.
As pristine parts of the world continue to shrink and we face the rapid population growth, active conservation management is obviously key to the success of many of these areas. Matt, as a conservationist, in short, where do you see yourself in the next few years, and where do you see conservation for ecosystems like this?
It's a tough question, Ross.
It's very open-ended.
Yeah, look, I think as conservationists around the world, we're certainly going to be faced with challenges as we move forward. I think one has to look at this as something where wildlife and people need to come together and live in some kind of harmonious space. We're all fighting for land. We all have our needs. And I think as populations increase in over the next 50 to 100 years, certainly predictions, if you look at forecasts within Africa alone, you know, populations are going to increase significantly. And it's how we embrace that. We have to embrace it. We can't have an attitude of, well, we need to bring more law enforcement into the system. That strategy isn't going to work. What will work is if we embrace our communities, we work with our communities, we work with our partners on the ground and invest in the areas within those communities that provide opportunities where they are the custodians just as much as the partners within the protected area. So that's why we've invested significantly into our communities. And one only has to forecast ahead and know that whatever we're spending now and whatever impact is being delivered through our programs now, we need to scale that up. How do we scale that up? And these are the questions that we are asking ourselves. If we want to maintain a sustainable, thriving entity, then that is going to be the requirement. And I think those are the challenges that we are all going to be faced with as land becomes fragmented and land use planning is going to be important. And all of these different elements that if we don't apply ourselves now and start adopting different strategies to cope with this increase in the human population, we're going to fail. And we're going to see these areas turned into agricultural systems. And when that happens, it's gone. So I think the challenge is how do we ensure that communities are taken care of and that their needs are being met, that their cultural needs are being accommodated so that these pristine, iconic landscapes continue to bring benefit to not only the local community, but to everyone around the world. These areas are going to be important for us.
There's always going to be this greater benefit for wildlife, the greater benefit for communities and outreaching communities beyond that. More and more through the various initiatives that the Grimedi Fund covers, I think already those are core principles that I think many organizations could easily follow suit because there's so much need for educating and passing on knowledge and also passing on the surety that we can sustain this between humans and wildlife living side by side, because this literally is what happens here.
Absolutely.
I think it's been an incredible podcast talking to you, Matt. There's many subjects that we could go on all day. Perhaps we'll have to look at a part two of this podcast. You have a pivotal role in the success of where Singita is located amongst the Serengeti ecosystem, and the Grimedi Fund's projects and initiatives are vital to this area. And I really appreciate your time today and bringing us into the conservation world as we look for the simple safari, the open space, seeking wilderness, seeking wholeness or wellness. We need to sometimes realize what happens behind the scenes to make sure that this takes place. And I really appreciate you bringing us into that world today. And I really thank you for your time.
Thanks, Ross. It's been a pleasure to talk to you today. There are a number of other initiatives that go on at the Grimedi Fund, and we'd be happy to talk to you about that in another podcast. But thanks very much, and it was a pleasure.
You can see more details on the Singita website or the Grimedi Fund website. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to another episode of the Singita Podcast Safari Conversations. If you want to follow other episodes of our podcast series, please follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from or on our website, singita.com. Until next time.
Thank you for listening. If you want to follow other episodes of our podcast series, Safari Conversations, please follow and subscribe wherever you get your podcast from or on our website at singita.com.